This is Sarah Reith with Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Today we'll hear from Mike Riddell, who moved to Greenfield with his two young daughters on Solstice of 1976. He was in the military in the early 60s, then became active in the radical student anti-war movement. He's comfortable with the types of seemingly contradictory things that characterize the Back to the Land epic, like hiring a water dowser to locate a good place to build a pond, then building that pond according to specs from an Army Corps of Engineers manual. Now he pays his taxes and his road association fees, grows fruit trees and raspberries, and takes pride in the accomplishments of his three grown daughters.
I moved here officially Solstice of 76. Well, I lived in San Francisco at the time. I had just finished my teaching credential in 75 and was getting a divorce, and I owned a house down there and I sold it. I had custody of my two daughters, and we're 3.5 and 5 years old. So I moved up here as a single dad, and here I am a few years later.
So why Mendocino County?
By chance, I had gone to high school in Santa Rosa, very close by, and I knew the area a bit, but I'd never thought of moving here. And then in 75, some friends of mine who lived in the city, who had two girls about the same age as my girls, had turned off and dropped out. You know, anyway, it was a mind blower to me. So I came up to visit them on the solstice of 75. And I couldn't believe it. That was down there at the pond at the ranch house at Greenfield. And there were 400 naked hippies dancing around having a good time. And I was intensely working all these jobs in the city and finishing school and raising my kids. I said, I'm getting out. So I went back and sold my house. And it took me a year, but I finally made it up here. The Back to the Land movement, as it was kind of quoted as, was something I had grown up with my youth. Until I was about six, I lived out in the country of Washington State. So I kind of liked the idea of living out in the country, and it was sort of a slight possibility we were going to be self-sufficient, which was kind of a fantasy, but a lot of people sort of believed in it. And as it, you know, turned out, we were somewhat self-sufficient, but it was a very short time before I was working in town. I had a job, and expectations are kind of unusual, because also in the late 60s, I was involved in the anti-war movement and the student movement. And I used to really preach against moving back to the land, stay in the city and fight the battle. That was the logo. I mean, the time, that was what we talked about a lot. So we wanted everybody to stay. And then here I found myself a few years later, yeah, get me out of here. I want to go to the country and relax. Mostly it was an unwinding. I had been living in so intensely, you know, in the city, going to school and working and raising kids, and it was just a relief to get out to the country. It was very nice because it was very supportive. I guess being a single dad, I got a lot of support, especially from the women thought kind of sympathized with me. You know, they would, poor guy, and help me out a little bit. You know, and there it was, helped me out a lot sometimes. So my impression was that I liked the community. Greenfield Ranch particularly has a pretty tight community, and it was evolving at the time. And growing. By 76, Greenfield had about 3 years of experience behind, you know, people living there. And it was good. People helped each other out a lot. And that's what you miss when you live in the city. You know, you can live 10 feet away from somebody in the city and not even know their name, really. The other thing that happened was the pot scene, of course. We all hear about that extensively. I attempted to do that to some degree for the first few years, but I was never into it so enthusiastically, so I wasn't so successful. I made a little money to pay for taxes and Christmas presents for the kids sometimes, but that was about it.
What about interactions with people who were already here and were not Back to the Landers?
At first, that's interesting, because there were a lot of the old-timers, we called them. You know, they were the old, good old boys and things like that. And some of them were receptive, and mostly not. I mean, it's like with any of those damned hippies coming into the neighborhood, you know, and they're ruining our lives. It's like you can always accuse them of being the outsiders coming in, disrupting your place. I remember particularly George Butler, who was very accepting, and his wife. they accepted us, and that was really it was really pleasant to be around with them. They had the Butler Ranch, Butler Cherry Ranch, and that was a very probably we used to go up there and hang out, and they were have these big dinners with a lot of the kids. We were all kids then, and we'd be 15, 20 of us hanging out there, bringing some food up, and they'd provide dinners, and we'd work on the ranch a bit, and it was fun. It was great.
So, what were some of the first homesteading tasks that you set yourself to once you moved back onto the land?
Well, the first thing I had to do was build a house. And I had, before I had moved up there, I had torn down a pretty large chicken coop in Santa Rosa, recycled lumber. And by the time, from the day that I arrived on the solstice of 76 until I had a roof over my head was 44 days. So I just worked at it really hard and, got, because I had to have a home for my kids. And so some of the neighbors came and helped a few times. There were, projects like that. And it was a lot of fun. It was a good time. It was summer, so it wasn't a real extremely hot summer. Shortly after that, I had a roof over my head and plastic over the holes where the windows were going, and an old tin wood stove, but stayed warm, had a place to cook. Everything was secure. And then my immediate neighbors over the hill and I decided that we needed to have water. So we looked it up about we got an Army Corps of Engineer manual, and we looked up ponds, how to build a pond. Well, first of all, we drilled a well. Waste of time, waste of money. And then we looked around at other options. We had some dowsers up about different places, and one dowser came up and said, water dowser, that is, he said, well, why don't you build a pond? So we looked it up. As I say, we got the Army Corps Engineer manual, and we looked it up how to do it, and we've done a rented a bulldozer. And between Dick Faxon and his wife, Marie, and myself, the three of us, we drove the bulldozer 22 hours a day for 14 days and built our first pond. It was the first pond on Greenfield. First, real 3 acre feet of water held back. And it was a very well done pond, still exists today. And so we were the first ones. And then I called the state water resources and asked them about it. And they said, you have to have a permit. So, how much is the permit? Well, permit's $10. So, and we're sending two engineers out to make sure you get it done right. So two engineers came from Sacramento, and I paid the $10 fee. And there were other people at that time building ponds, so we decided to, a few people applied for permits. A year later, the pond permit fee went up to $100. And so that was, kind of a big jump, but you can understand why, sending two engineers out.
What about Class K? Were you involved in any of the so-called code wars?
Oh, yes. I was very involved in it. The building inspector at the time, he was a real good old boy. On Greenfield, I was on the building committee, and so we would go and see him. But we discussed him. Now, what about using used materials, recycled materials? No, you can't do that. They have to be inspected. He was just down on everything we tried. And there wasn't a Class K quite yet. That hadn't come into being. Then it was clean slate, which was another option that you had for building. It means you could go back on a house that was already built, and they would inspect it and see if it passed the requirements that they needed. And then they'd sign you off. You paid the building permit fees, et cetera, et cetera. And then Class K came in about the same time. So Class K was a statewide thing. Clean slate was a Mendocino County thing. And so I worked with that, and I helped a lot of people in my neighborhood get through that process. And then one of the processes was, of course, the health issue was, how do you deal with your septic, septic systems? And most people did that. A lot of people didn't. They're still living with an outhouse and, illegally. Most of my house is Class K, even though I probably could have passed the Uniform Building Code with it, so...
So did you have any experiences in your upbringing or your education that prepared you for moving back to the land?
Well, as a matter of fact, my parents were high school sweethearts. And when they graduated, I can trace back when, 9 months before I was born was graduation day. So when that was the Second World War. And so when the war was over and they were back home, they were totally different people. And when I was born, my mother was only 18, so she turned me over to live with my grandmother. My grandmother and grandfather were they were loggers, and they lived in the woods in Washington State. And so I grew up the first 6 years of my life literally living in the woods with an outhouse and a wash tub to take a bath in. And so it was kind of a familiar thing. And I didn't realize at the time when I was moving here that was really what I was probably seeking, a lot of that, you know.
So can you talk a little bit about raising your kids back to the land? You said you were a single dad. And how did you figure out education and keeping your kids safe and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I had two girls, 3.5 and 5, when I first moved here. And we didn't have TV or anything. And as I say, they learned to read very early and avidly read tons of books and had a great time. And I'm thinking, we had a school on Greenfield Ranch. The school was very informal, and unfortunately there was some learning processes, but some of it not. I taught a little bit at the school, and every parent had a little responsibility. And I think it was in 77, the fall of 77, the school kind of started falling apart, and people weren't showing up on time. And the kids had an hour and 15-minute walk to get to school. And there were 12 kids in the neighborhood that all used to walk. I would never let them do it now, because now we have lions and tigers and bears. At that time, there really weren't any bears or mountain lions around. But when Masonites started logging all that 5,000, 50,000 acres, whatever it was, they drove a lot of those animals in our direction. And so now we see mountain lions and bears quite often. But as the kids grew up, I decided to send them to Waldorf School. Yeah, it was a pretty good education for them. And then when they went to high school, they were very well prepared for high school. But, you know, we didn't have TV, so they spent a lot of time reading, and we spent a lot of time talking, and I read out loud to them all the time. Whenever they did the dishes, we had stories to read, you know, so that was part of the process. They did pretty well. My second daughter has a PhD, and my oldest daughter has a master's in nursing, and my baby daughter, who was born with my second wife, is a ranger in Alaska for the federal forest land.
You mentioned previously that there are now mountain lions and bears on Greenfield, but I'm wondering if you had any interesting encounters with wildlife.
The first time I saw bears was the time when they closed the Willits dump. They estimated there were 80 bears that lived in the dump. And some of those bears migrated down. And I put up a sign. I said, I'm willing to share, just don't break the branches. But they didn't read, see? So the bears would come in my orchard. I have about 40 fruit trees. And they would break the branches. So at first I was really angry about that. And I was ready to shoot him. And I called the Fish and Game. And Fish and Game sent a man up right then. He was there that same day. And he issued me a depredation permit, which was good for 30 days. He said, you have to shoot him with the rifle, not the shotgun. Okay, so I was getting ready to do that. And then one of my neighbors said, no, 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 no. Don't shoot the bears. News talk radio. He put a radio down on the orchard. And at 6 p.m., they up the amps quite a bit, and it sounds loud. And News Talk Radio has voices of two or three different people, like, arguing over things, you know, rah, 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 making a lot of noise. And it sure did work. I put it down there. I never had a bear problem after that, at least in the orchard. Now, since then, about 3 years ago, I had a bear get in and eat all my chickens. And I didn't know what it was at first. I didn't realize it was a bear, but he ripped all the boards off the bottom of the coop, got in, and ate the chickens. So now I have an electric fence, and that works fine. It keeps the bears out, keeps the coyotes out. Foxes are tricky little. They're very foxy. They're a little tricky. And so are the coyotes. They're very wily. The foxes used to come around, and they would eat my raspberries. In about 5 or 6 in the afternoon, broad daylight, I said, I can't believe it. There was this fox out there up on his hind legs picking the raspberries like a person and gobbling them down. And the other thing that was happening at that time was we would miss, if you lay a pair of gloves down in the garden, one glove's gone. Or a pair of work shoes or something like that, one shoe is gone. So finally, yeah, I'm ready. This is it. I'm going to shoot that little bugger. And I got my gun out, and I got up to a good high spot, and here's the fox running across the orchard, and out to come two little kits with gloves in their hand, gloves in their mouth, playing with them, you know, like little dogs. I said, that's not fair. I took a few shots around them, bang, 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 and it scared them off. And I didn't have them back for a long time. So that was my fox experience, although lately they've been coming back again, so foxes. And raccoons, of course, everybody has raccoon issues. Again, raccoon issues. So one day, this raccoon with three babies, right, three baby raccoons, I catch it on one of my apple trees, and I go, yell, get down here, you know, you guys get out of here, leave the apples alone. So they all climb down from the tree, and they come very slowly, kind of walking. The mother's kind of looking, come on, let's go, God. Let's go, kids, come on. And then I have a small apple tree that was down there a little ways, and the mother goes over to the fence, and she's trying to get through the fence, and the three little ones crawl up the little tree. They're about this high off the ground. They're all hanging on like this, and I walk right up to them and say, you guys get out of here, you know. And they still come back again. Raccoons are persistent and very tricky. They've done some really tricky things to get some food, you know.
Can you talk about ways that you figured out how to feed yourself on the ranch, or was it all going to the grocery store?
Well, the reality of it is you can work for your food and raise them. I've had a pretty substantial garden at different times and, you know, grown corn and squash and tomatoes and all the usual things plus. And it's a lot of work, and especially if you're working in town, especially if you're raising kids. So I do the easy things. The raspberries are fairly easy. The apples, I get, you know, pretty substantial apple crop, and I have an apple pressing party in the fall every year and make a lot of apple juice. I think we made 50 gallons of juice one year, and we usually get 100 quarts at least.
You arrived at Greenfield on solstice, and I'm wondering if you could talk about special occasions or solstice parties at Greenfield.
Yes, typically at Greenfield there's three parties that they're significant. The solstice, the summer solstice, and then the Halloween, and then the winter solstice party. The winter solstice is typically combined with sort of a New Year's Eve, and a couple of the people have birthdays very close then, and so there's sort of this little gathering. It's usually pretty small for the winter one, but the Halloween party is usually big, pretty good. We used to do it as a fundraiser for our roads, and a few times we raised a lot of money. Then we found out we had to pay taxes on it because we're supposedly a nonprofit. We are a nonprofit or a not-for-profit corporation. But when we have raised money, we said, oh, we're supposed to take taxes on that. Our bookkeeper told us that. But our budget used to be, you know, $7,000-$8,000 a year. Now we're up to $50,000-$60,000 a year. Because it just costs more for everything so much nowadays. We pay for insurance. You know, we never used to pay insurance. You know, hippies don't pay insurance, you know. But now we pay insurance. And anyway, it's, you know.
Do you have a particularly emblematic moment of any kind of special gathering that happened?
In the early days, as I say, Greenfield was we're all younger generations and a lot of single people. And there were a lot of incest, you might say, for the ranch. And so the parties were really good, and people would go all out to dress up and get some really great costumes. In those days, I remember one of the guys would come. He came with these, and it was unusual to have these lights that were portable, like you have Christmas lights that work from batteries. Very rare. That was a new innovation. And I remember one of the guys came with that. He was all lit up, and he was dancing, and everybody was just kind of, wow, that was amazing. But yeah, those were the big ones. And then the summer solstice parties have always been good. And, you know, there's sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you know, great times. And now that we're all in our 60s and 70s, it's quite different. You know, it used to be a lot of fun to go down and look at all the naked hippies dancing around. Now it's kind of like, oh, look at those old people. It's still good. They're all good friends, you know, people that are nice.
So I know that psychedelics were a big part of the era, and I'm wondering if that played a role for you.
Very minor. You know, when you could go down to the pond in those days, and there would be Mushroom Julie and Acid David, and so, you know, the different people who had their supplies of whatever the drugs were at the time. But I was into smoking pot a little bit, you know, but a few times I did some acid. But it was not a real big focus to me. I had lived in the era of I was in the military in the early 60s, and then after that I got involved in the anti-war movement, and I was involved in Students for Democratic Society. Is that familiar? Yeah, okay, so it's the radical student movement, and I got out of the military in 67, got involved in 68, and we were particularly not anti-drugs so much, but we didn't tolerate any of us having drugs because the cops would bust you and plant drugs on you. That was commonly known. And if you were known for not having drugs, it was very hard for them to do that. They couldn't say, yeah, we found all this stuff on them. Well, no, they don't do drugs. So that was our movement. You know, and so we did that. And I still kind of held on to that a little bit. I wasn't so much into the drug scene. And I owned a house in the city. I was kind of living a semi-straight life, you know, pretty much. When I came to Greenfield, everybody was into the pot scene. That was a big deal. I mean, there were some big crops in those early days. I couldn't believe it. I was astounded at the money that was made. And yeah, hey, okay. I didn't get much of it, but... And, you know, all in all, Greenfield's interesting in different ways because you can see the professional type or the people who wanted to pursue a career and did, you know, they commuted to town, did their jobs. And there's still a number of people in the ranch that are still living the life of that hippie era thing where there was, it's hard to describe, it's not lazy, but just not motivated to be participating in the bigger society. Still very community-oriented, though. Almost everybody is up there.
Can you talk about how you organized yourselves as a community at Greenfield and how you made sure that roads were maintained and that there were rules and that people followed them?
That's an interesting story in itself because when I first came to the ranch, it used to be first Sunday or last Sunday of the month was a general meeting. And anybody who showed up at the general meeting was on the board of directors for that week or that month. So decisions were made by the board who happened to ever be there. And if something got decided one month, the next month the people who opposed it would come and vote against it. So nothing really got done too much. And I think it was about 84 or 5 like that, that it was about 10 of us that decided, let's have a real board of directors. So we went to the ranch house and the way we elected a board of directors was you put your name in a can and you drew your name out. And so we had 10 people's name in the can. We drew our names out. We're the board of directors. So we kind of took over the ranch, but we made things happen after that. We started collecting assessments, they were supposed to be collected anyway. We actually had to go to small claims court and take some of our neighbors to small claims court, which caused a lot of grumbling and rifts. But yeah, that's a whole nother story.
So what about communication systems?
That's another issue. That's a whole, yeah, we started out, let's see, the 70s, the late 70s, the big thing was to get CBs. And we had a CB night. I think 8 o'clock at night, every night, people would turn on the CBs and talk back and forth if you could get somebody. Where I was on the north side of the ranch, there were only about 3 people I could get. One of them was Leonard Lake. You heard that story. Well, the communications went from CBs, and there was one phone line that came to the ranch house. There was a pay phone in the ranch house, and one other person on the way to the ranch house, they had a pay phone off that line. And then I put a 2.5-mile extension cord up to my house. Actually, variable. It wasn't just an extension cord, but there were 5 of us that went in on it. We put a phone line up there. And then other people around the ranch did it too. So we had landlines in for a number of years. I found that every year, I had to go out at least once a year, maybe twice a year, and fix the line. And I got to the point where I knew where all the breaks were going to be. Animals bit them, chewing a branch fell on it. And even though it was variable cable, burying that much cable through the woods, we got about 1/3 of it actually buried. The other thing was just laying on the ground. So that's why we had constant repairs. And then along came these phones that you could hold in your hand and talk on, the cell phone thing. And that was a whole new game. So 3-4 years ago, Linda Gray on the other side of the ranch and I think a couple other people looked into these new radios, private frequency radio, and they'll work up to 10 miles or something like that, mainly for fire safety. And when this fire happened last year, 2017 fire, they were really useful because our cell phones went down, the internet went down, and we still had these radios. Yeah, so we still have that radio system in, and that's been very effective. Besides our cell phones, when you have cell service, I learned that it wasn't always reliable, cell service.
and talk a little bit more about the relationships that people had and how you think they changed the culture and the way that people relate to each other.
I inherited on the ranch, I have a copy of the 1973 videotapes that were made by Haven Logan and her boyfriend at the time. And they interviewed most of the early people on Greenfield. And it was very interesting to see that almost all of those people interviewed had some goal in life, what they wanted to do. And Lynn Meadows wanted to do medicine and become a medical person. Her husband, Bob Dress, wanted to be a builder. Dennis Patton wanted to be a winemaker. These kinds of things. And there's about 15 people on there, including Kate. I've got videos of Kate in 73 and Bob Currier. And Bob was going to be a musician, and he wanted to do all this. And Kate wanted to be involved in the Playhouse. And, you know, these kinds of things. And most of those people went on to do those things. It's very impressive. They stayed with it, and they contributed a lot to our community. And Greenfield contributed. You know, people from Greenfield started the co-op. They started the community theater. McCavin was started by Greenfielders. Deborah Mead, she helped to start McCavin. And then the Playhouse was Kate and Bob Currier. And
how has the experience changed your life?
I think that people judge their experience and their lives. You know, looking, of course, now I look back on my life. Day before yesterday, I went to a memorial service for a friend of mine at Santa Rosa. And it was like, you know, meeting all these people that I hadn't seen in a long time. And everybody kind of reflects on their lives, and you look back on how your kids are. You know, are they doing things? Are they successful? Are they happy? And if they are, that really makes a difference. I feel very fortunate. My girls have just, they've done great. And I, you know, that's all I can judge it by. I say, they're doing good. What have I got? Well, I've got some years left, I hope.
You've been listening to Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. We just heard from Mike Riddell, who moved to Greenfield in 1976. For all the archived episodes with photos and more, just type Promise of Paradise, KZYX, into your search engine. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, Story Center, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear.